everyone out. We welcome those joining us online. We're glad that you're here worshiping with us, whatever manner that may be. This morning, we're going to start a new idea or a new series about sort of how we realize that we live in a culture that is becoming more apathetic and sometimes even a little hostile towards the beliefs and the lives of Christians. Now, we live in a pretty good area. There aren't very many places that I have to go or that I do go where I have to hide that I'm a preacher. Maybe sometimes I do, but that's a whole different story altogether. But there's no place really that I have to. But those places that I do, and you tell people you're a preacher, sometimes it can get lonely pretty quick. But typically, we live in a pretty good area. But it is growing more apathetic towards Christian values and towards Christian beliefs. And one day, it's not there, but it's not hard to see that it could increasingly become more hostile, right? And we don't have to look very far to see that. We can turn on the news and we can see a little bit of that. We can log in online to our social media of choice and we can see that, right? We live in a world that really seems to be just going in the complete opposite direction of what Christians should be doing. And that's the world, right, that we've been called into by Christ to go out into. So how do we do that? How do we go on and hold on to our godly principles in an increasingly ungodly culture? That we need to sort of ask ourselves daily, how are we going to do that? How are we going to live holding on to our godly principles in an ungodly world and maybe not be a jerk about it? Because that's probably sort of the kicker, isn't it? Is that we can live countercultural and nobody wants to join us. But that's not the call of Christ. The call of Christ is to live countercultural and to call others to him. And so I guess lucky for us, this is not a new question that God's people have had to deal with. It's a very ancient question, one that was asked and answered in the Old Testament in the book of Daniel. And so really until maybe the beginning of December, we're going to spend a lot of time in the book of Daniel and more so in the life of Daniel. And so if you've read the book of Daniel, we did a Wednesday night class on it not too long ago. But the first half of Daniel is pretty awesome. The second half of Daniel is pretty awesome too, right? But kind of in a different way. It kind of turns into apocalyptic literature, and it's a little bit wild and crazy. And we'll meet that when we get to it. But today we'll start with the story of Daniel. And sort of what we can learn from that. The book of Daniel starts off like this. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, his being Nebuchadnezzar, with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them, he again being Nebuchadnezzar, he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. And so the book of Daniel starts off with the Babylonians being used as God's instrument to punish the Israelites living in Judah for their lack of obedience. We've talked about Micah for several weeks. Verses 1 and 2 here want us to be very clear, especially verse 2, that it was the Lord that gave Nebuchadnezzar victory. That it was the Lord who sent the Babylonians. King Nebuchadnezzar is God's pawn, sort of in this chess game here. The book of Daniel wants us to see that. The Babylonians have conquered Judah, and in the following years, they're going to have three different deportations of the Israelites. The first one here is where it's going to take Daniel and his friends. About 10 years later, they're going to come and they're going to take Ezekiel and his friends. And then about 10 years after that, the Israelites still in Jerusalem and in Judah are still kind of causing problems. And so Nebuchadnezzar comes in a third time and he just levels Jerusalem. And he takes out just about everyone else that was left and he brings them into captivity, and he takes some people that he had in captivity from other places, and he roosts them in that land of Judah. And so now you have foreigners living in a foreign place, and you have foreigners now living where the Jewish people once lived. And so three different deportations happen in the book of Daniel. We're really going to just focus on Daniel's deportation. And the thing is you have to understand that this is God's plan. Not just by what Daniel said, but years earlier, the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 39, beginning in verse 5, Isaiah says this to King Hezekiah. Years before Daniel, Isaiah says to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon." Now, at this time, Babylon was not a world power. They were certainly moving up, but they weren't really a threat to anybody. Assyria was taking care of the world at this point. But Isaiah is saying there's going to come a time when the Babylonians are going to come in and they're going to carry off all the treasure. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Isaiah, hundreds of years before, is talking about Daniel and his friends. And so we pick up verse 3 in Daniel 1. The king Nebuchadnezzar commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. That is a story we all know, right? Most of us know that story. When you hear the names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you remember those guys. Those are the fiery furnace guys. We think of the lion's den with Daniel. All of this started with King Nebuchadnezzar taking these young men into captivity. And just consider a few things about what Nebuchadnezzar is doing when he goes in to a nation. Now, he's already conquered the nation. He wipes out the army. He then goes parading through the streets. And he takes all of the household gods of that place to say, "I am a bigger god than the one you worship. I have taken over that god." That's what he's saying. He comes through and he takes all of these sacred objects out of the temple. And then if that isn't enough, he takes the next generation's best and brightest. He takes the best looking, the smartest young men of the kingdom that he conquered, and he brings them back to assimilate them to Babylonian culture. So not only is Nebuchadnezzar conquering a nation, but now he's trying to conquer or win the hearts of the next generation. And so what is happening is it's a very successful in most of the lands he conquers. Because what happens is they come back, they bring these people back, and they're sort of treated like royalty in an empire that is growing, that has just defeated them. And they're treated well because Nebuchadnezzar knows you win the next generation's hearts, you have them forever. And that's a pretty good lesson for us, right? Satan is working hard to win the next generation's hearts because he knows if he wins them, he sort of wins the game, right? Not the ultimate game. Obviously, we know that. I'm not talking about that. But he wins us. We will be no more if we allow Satan to have the next generation. So one of the reasons to look at the book of Daniel is because Daniel shows us how to live in a world that is trying to pick off the next generation. He shows us what we can do when we are living in Babylon. So sort of put yourself in Daniel's shoes just for a little bit. But by no fault of Daniel's, he was taken into captivity. He didn't do anything wrong. Maybe sort of how the beginning reads, he may not have been old enough to necessarily do anything wrong. It's not his fault that the Lord is punishing the Israelites. It's not Daniel's fault that he gets taken into captivity. He gets his name changed from Daniel, which means God will judge, to Belshazzar, which means Baal will protect. What a name change, right? The God that conquered him, his name is now that God will protect you. That's some psychological stuff going on there for Daniel and his friends. Then he has to deal with that, but that's not really even the biggest indignity. Isaiah prophesies that they will become eunuchs. And this is a pretty common practice in those days. If you're going to serve the king's house, you're certainly not going to mess with any of his ladies. And so you would be castrated as men. That's probably the reason we don't read about Daniel and his friends having families, is because this is what happened to them. So by no fault of your own, you're taken in to captivity to a foreign land. You're deprived of being a father, of having a family. Now, would you be bitter if you were in Daniel's place in that moment? I think from our understanding, Daniel has every right to be at least a little bit angry, right? He could be angry at his ancestors. It's their fault that God is judging now. Isaiah is the one who prophesied to this. He could be angry at the Babylonians. They're the ones coming in and doing all this stuff. They got plenty of land in Babylon, right? They don't need to come all this way and take more land. He could be angry at God, because if he understands that God is behind all of this, then in our kind of way of thinking, he would have every right to be a little bit angry and bitter. But one of the most fascinating things about the book of Daniel is how positive and how uplifting and how encouraging Daniel is throughout the whole ordeal. At every turn, every time adversity comes his way, he's calm, he's positive, and he's effective. And he has, in our human understanding, no right to be. Nothing in his life would point him to this wonderful enthusiasm that we can sort of see coming off the page. He makes this choice, and when he makes it, it has a ripple effect for generations. How are we going to navigate a world that doesn't have the same values as we do? How can that be part of our thing? Daniel will spend the rest of his life in faithful service to God. He's going to be helpful to his friends, and he's going to serve his government. Not a government of his choosing. And he's still going to serve it. Over these next several weeks, I'm going to repeat this phrase, but catch on to it now. Daniel served God in Babylon, and Daniel served Babylon for God. That's going to be sort of the secret sauce for this whole series of lessons that we need to understand as we live in our modern day Babylon, is that we can still serve God in Babylon, whatever Babylon looks like now. Babylon throughout Scripture, when you get into Revelation and stuff, it's there to help us understand empires that are against God. Everything that they do, and I think pretty much every empire of the world of all time fits into that category. And as much as it pains me, the one that we live in, right, fits into that category. We live in a modern day Babylon. And you can still serve God in modern day Babylon. And you can still serve modern day Babylon for God. Daniel shows us how to navigate, I think, this culture that really doesn't endorse our values. Now, traditionally, we've gone through maybe three different responses of how we respond to a culture that doesn't uphold our values. And the first one is we sort of pull away from the culture. You sort of think maybe like the Amish or the Mennonites, how they have done things. There are other groups that have done this too, that instead of engaging in any culture, that they kind of sequester themselves, kind of build some walls, whether they're real walls or maybe they move out to Utah, other kind of walls of just getting away and saying nothing here from culture. We don't want to be influenced by culture, and so our best way to respond to that is to pull away completely from them. So that's number one. A lot of Christians have done that. Not just Christian groups, but a lot of Christian individuals have done this as well. Just sort of pulled away from the culture and have still worshiped within churches and done sorts of things, but they've pulled away from culture so as not to engage in it. The second option, though, is those who haven't pulled away, they actually start pushing back against culture. You think several years ago, maybe they're still doing it, but the Westboro Baptist Church in Wichita, Kansas, where they would go and protest like soldiers' funerals and things like that. They got really popular from a time, but it's like those picket signs. It's coming out and it's protesting. Culture is going this way, and then you have a group of people who are claiming to be Christians that say, no, culture should not go that way. And so they stand out there. It's when they're proclaiming their values and trying to impose them on people who don't have the same set of values. They don't have the same standing to even come close to the same value set. And so they will stand in picket lines. Some will be in protest. Some respond to culture that they don't agree with by pushing back. And then the third option, instead of pulling away or pushing back, some people say, you know what? I don't like either one of those options. I'm going to just go with the flow. Now, I'm going to just sort of water down the message a little bit so it doesn't have a very big ripple effect in my life. I'm not going to pull away, and I'm not going to push back. I'm just going to see where culture's going, and I'm going to adopt it. I'm going to sort of baptize it a little bit by saying, well, you know, culture is doing this. It's not quite right, so we're going to do this. It's close. And it makes us look like culture, but it's not, because we're still proclaiming Christ. I'm going to tell you that all three of those, pushing back or pulling away or going with the flow, none of those options are ideal or good. None of those options is what God desires from his peoples. Daniel will show us another option. Daniel will show us that we can serve Babylon and serve Babylon for God, or serve God in Babylon. And so this next section, it's going to be some pretty lengthy. I apologize to Kathy. She's going to have to read along and click with us. But it begins in verse 8. Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So would you endanger my head with the king? Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Verse 13, he says, then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were in better appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Maybe the first time vegetables, kids requested vegetables, right? Verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill and all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of that time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. Verse 20 says, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Maybe the first thing to see there is we should never be amazed about what the younger generation can do for the glory of God. That sometimes it's a big disservice whenever we consider the younger generation simply as the future of the church. That is true, but they also should be the present of our church, right? Because sometimes the present will put us to shame whenever we look at what stories they have and we look at their faithfulness through the adversity that they have to deal with every day of their life. Kids should not be discounted. Daniel and his friends should not have to deal with the things that they're dealing with. But they did deal with it. And they did deal with it in such a way that it would change the way a nation would respond to the Babylon that they're in, because four young men would choose to be faithful. So never underestimate the power of faithfulness, no matter what, whether it be age or any box that somebody tries to put you in, right? It's gender or race or socioeconomic status. Those things don't matter. Living a faithful life is an impressive thing. So three quick things to sort of bring out is, number one is choose your battles that really matter. And as Christians, that's what we like to do, right? We love to debate. Maybe that's a byproduct of years gone past, but we like to be right, especially in our heritage and in our culture. We've sort of based most of our understanding on the fact that we are right in all of our interpretations and in all of our understanding of the scripture. That we're 100% right in this, and so many times we want to be right that when we see something that isn't quite right, maybe it's clearly wrong, we want to challenge it, right? We want to push back. We want to be seen as being right. Daniel doesn't take that battle. Daniel doesn't protest changing his name. His name was a godly name, and now he was given a pagan god's name. Daniel doesn't protest. You don't see him going, I'm not going by that name. That name is blasphemous. Daniel doesn't protest this. He doesn't refuse to learn a new language. He doesn't even skip the lessons on dream interpretation, something that would not be acceptable in Israel, something that was not to be according to the law of Israel. He doesn't skip those lessons. He doesn't treat his captors like enemies. He doesn't impose his values on them. Daniel doesn't expect them to live like he does. All of these are battles that he doesn't fight. There is a battle that he does choose to fight. And I think it's fascinating because of all the things he could push back on, what he pushes back on is food. And he refuses the good stuff. I don't know any other way to put that. They are given the choice meat to eat and the choice drink that the king himself partakes of. Literally, the best the land has to offer for these young men. And Daniel says, no thanks. And that sort of seems like an odd thing if you think about it. Why that battle? What point does that serve? It's sort of, we're a little bit removed from how the king's food was served. And we sort of talked about it Wednesday night when we talked about the wave offerings that God commanded the Israelites to do. What happens is whenever the cooks would prepare the food for the king, the first thing that they would do is they would come out and they would wave it in the honor of the king's God. And then they would give it to the king to eat. And when you ate the king's meat, that showed that you were in fellowship. You are in agreement with the king's gods. Food is important. We don't let anybody ever tell you differently, right? Next week, we're going to have a great potluck. And we always have great potlucks. Food is important. And the reason it's important is not simply because of the food itself and what the food is. It's because of what we are telling people when we eat. Whenever I sit down with someone to eat, I am telling them, you are telling them, you are worthy to sit down and eat with. I think You are worth it. I may not see eye to eye with you at everything in that moment, but in that moment, I am in agreement with that person. And it's hard, right? It's hard to fight with someone when your knees have touched underneath a table. It can happen, don't get me wrong, but never underestimate the power of food and fellowship. Daniel certainly didn't. He said, you can change my name, you can educate me about your God, you can do all of these things to me, but I'm not going to worship your God in eating that food. That is an act of worship I will not participate in. So choose our battles wisely. Let's be honest for a moment. We have fought a whole bunch of battles, sort of the worship wars about the right time to have worship service and what all should happen in the worship service and who can do what in the worship service. And we have sort of all of these battles that what may be appropriate and what shouldn't be appropriate. And sometimes when those matters, we muddy up the waters for people to hear the good news. So many times we get so much into the different issues that we've forgotten that the real issue at stake is people's souls. Do they know Jesus? Now, I am not saying other issues are not important, but I am saying that they should pale in comparison to what is most important. And so we should choose our battles wisely. We need to choose battles that really matter, because if we lose on this, we sort of miss the point on everything. So choosing battles really matters. The second thing is hold your convictions graciously. It's clear that they had convictions. But notice, Daniel and his friends, when they take a stand, they do it without being rude. They do it without being obnoxious or disrespectful or arrogant. And this is a theme all throughout this book, that they do these things and they don't mock or whine or scream about it. They hold their convictions clearly and strongly, but they hold their convictions without holding in contempt those who don't hold the same convictions as they do. And that's a hard thing to do, right? Isn't it? I mean, to hold their convictions strongly without holding in contempt that someone that doesn't have the same convictions as I do, that's a life lesson that I need to learn from Daniel. I'm convinced that if more Christians were like Daniel, we would have a whole lot more converts. But sort of, what we end up doing is a lot of times we hold our convictions like a hammer, and we are ready to pound anybody over the head that doesn't agree with us on those things. Daniel asks permission for him to continue holding his convictions. Here's my conviction. He goes up the chain of command. He doesn't try to hide it. He doesn't try to go around it. He goes straight to the one that's in charge, and he says, hey, here's my convictions. It's against my convictions to eat this meat and to drink this wine. So would you allow me to eat vegetables and drink water? Now, if the world saw Christians being that gracious with our convictions, I think they would be like, hold up. I want to pay a little bit more attention to what these guys are doing. The steward says, I'm afraid for my own life. If I do this, the king's going to take off my head. And Daniel says, let's talk about this for a minute. They have a conversation. Daniel says, let's try this. We need to hold our convictions gracefully. Paul would say in the New Testament to the church in Rome, in Romans 12:18, that if possible, so far it depends on you, live peaceably with all. I had to look up what all meant in the Greek, because, you know, that can get a little bit confusing. In the Greek, the word for all, it's interesting, it means all, everyone. It doesn't say to live at peace with the people that look like you. It doesn't say live at peace with the people who agree with you. It doesn't say live at peace with the people that you've chosen. What it says is to live at peace with all. And I think how you do that is you are gracious, especially with your convictions. And that is not easy to do in this world, but it is very much appreciative. And it is very effective in winning souls. So that's the second thing. The last thing, and I promise we'll finish, is trust the impact of an obedient life. People are not convicted by how loud we shout, but they are convicted with how we live and how well we live. Our Babylonian friends, they need to see the way we live works. Then you see the way that we live, the way that we are walking through this life actually does work. Then maybe they become interested in that as well. You think about just the other day, you go to a funeral of someone who dies, a Christian person that dies, and there are Christians that are there that surround them, but there are also people there that are not part of Christ. And they're sort of looking at that family and they go, "You guys are weird. You're almost rejoicing in your grief." And you're like, that's true, because it is a better way to live, because we have hope, and anyone that has hope has a better way to live. Trust me, they don't care how loud we shout. We can do it until we pass out. If you live well, that's what gets noticed. Daniel and his friends do this. Daniel asks the official about the test. He says, "Put us on the vegetable and water diet." And he says, "I don't know about that, because the king might chop my head off." And Daniel says, "I got a way around the test. Do it for 10 days. And the official has to do the math and says, "This is a 3-year program. 10 days isn't going to make that big a difference. I'll fatten them up if I have to." And so he agrees, and 10 days later, he's blown away by what he sees. It's not what he expected. They never, I think, underestimate the impact of a faithful, obedient life. When someone is truly holding to their convictions graciously, the impact is impressive. We don't, and I'm talking to myself because I'm the worst one at it. We don't need to rant and rave about the unrighteous in this world. Rather, we need to live righteous, to let people see that there is a better way to live. And is it social media? Isn't this the worst of all of those devils? Where you have plenty of people on there and they just want to give their opinion about everything, and sometimes it's just so annoying and you can't help but join in on that. But you know, we really don't need to be joining in on that. What our Babylonian friends need to see for us is to live an obedient life and to show them that the life is blessed. Peter would pick up on this theme in 1 Peter 2. He says in verse 11, "Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul." It's the same idea, right? Choose your battles wisely. Keep your conduct among Gentiles honorable. Same idea, hold your convictions graciously so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. And so number three, the true impact of an obedient life. But by the end of this chapter, Daniel, these four teenage boys or young men, that they were able to serve the king Nebuchadnezzar better because they first honored another king. Sort of, they were able to do their secular jobs better because they honored the true king first. I think that same lesson applies to us. Well, I don't think we're that far removed from Babylon. We're not that far removed from Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I think their story is quite often our story. And so when we find ourselves in Babylon, may we have that kind of impact that these young men had. Maybe learn and grow into our service, that we can serve God in Babylon and we can serve Babylon for God. And so this morning, I don't know what the Spirit has been convicting you of. I do know that each of us needs to be better in our service to this world so that we can honor the King of Kings throughout this world. Maybe that's where we're at. May we have that kind of impact that God desires. And so this morning, if you would like prayers in that journey, maybe you came here this morning and you've never given your life to Christ, that you're ready to put Christ on in baptism. If you are ready, we are more than ready. Christ is absolutely ready for you to begin that journey with God. Whatever your need may be, please come as together we stand and we sing.